Hi, I'm Tom Rogers, Vice President of the Qigong Institute. This is the seventh in the Qigong Institute series of podcasts about Qigong. The Qigong Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to Qigong research and education and to educating the public on the immediate and long-term benefits of Qigong. We welcome your donations to help pay for the website operation and ongoing Qi programs. This podcast was specially created to report on the first international Tai Chi Chuan Symposium on Health, Education, and Cultural Exchange held in the United States. It was the first symposium of its kind in the U.S. and the largest outside of China. Dr. Roger Yonka, an Oriental medical doctor and one of the leading voices in the evolution of complementary and alternative medicine, attended the conference. I know that Dr. Yonka feels that this is a real watershed piece of history in the adoption of Eastern healing modalities by mainstream Western medicine, and that he has some really striking insights. So, Dr. Yonka, can you start with some of the practical logistical info?
Yeah, Tom, but first let me just say that I really appreciate the great work of the Qigong Institute, and I love the magnitude of the work that you and your colleagues have presented on the Qigong Institute website, and I'm honored to be here today with you. So this event, the Tai Chi Symposium, it was actually called the, as you said, first international Tai Chi Chuan Symposium, occurred at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, and I was honored to be invited to present some research that myself and colleagues here at the Institute of Integral Qigong and Tai Chi have been working on for a number of years. And the overall, the whole idea of this conference was very special from the very first, because there have been lots of Tai Chi events in and out of China over the years. And there have been some scientific events, although not anywhere near as much on the science here in the Western world. But there had never really been an event where the science and the research was parallel with the program that was parallel at this event was these incredible characters from the tradition of Tai Chi in China. So the key people from each of the families, the Yang family, the Chen family, the Wu family, and the Sun family, were literally there teaching classes. So the back-to-back or the parallel of the traditional information from these master teachers along with the contemporary science was just striking. Absolutely striking. And there were people there from all sorts of agencies and institutions from the science side. So Harvard University was there, University of California. Our colleague from the IIQTC, Linda Larkey from Arizona State University, and numerous people from schools and training institutes for Tai Chi and Qigong throughout the United States and the world, along with these grandmasters from the traditional Tai Chi Chuan styles, and in many cases their kids and nieces and nephews, because in many of these families there's more or less interest on the parts of the younger people in these practices. And so the whole lineage aspect of Tai Chi is going through a change right now. For instance, in the Yang family, Yang Jinduo is the older guy, 83 years old. And there's been, you know, there's always debate about who's going to be the next person and so forth. And Yang Jun, not his son, for instance, kind of strange. Well, what happened to Yang Jinduo's son? I'm not sure, but it looks like his grandson is going to be taking over there. And it was especially interesting, and we'll talk more about this, to see people from the Yang family in the Chen classes, and to see people from the Chen family in the Yang classes. That was an amazing experience for me.
Okay, so who thought of the conference and who organized it? And so what was the principle behind getting all these people together?
The lineage or the sort of historic events that led up to this conference are primarily that the Yang family, International Society for Yang Tai Chi, something like that, was celebrating its 10th anniversary. And apparently, a number of people came up with the idea, well, if we're going to celebrate this, why not invite all the families? And there's one other event in the history of Tai Chi where these particular families all met outside of China, and that was, I think, somewhere around 5 years ago at a place called Thunder Bay. And there were a number of people at this particular conference who reflected on the Thunder Bay conference. But this was the first time that the science track was parallel. And that really, the credit for that really goes to Yang Yang from the University of Illinois. Yang Yang saw an opportunity for this gathering of Tai Chi wizards to be parallel with some of the evidence-based investigations that are happening at the universities. And so it appeared to me that it kind of like evolved like that. It was interesting to see the other families, the Wu family, Sun family, and the Chen family, so heartily supporting the International Yang Family Society. That was one of the things that was particularly inspiring about this event was, and we'll talk about this more too as we go further on, is that whole concept of, shall we say, exclusivity that has traditionally existed in the martial arts, and the fact that that has a lot to do with dynasties and the military influences in Chinese culture and so forth. And I think we'll probably talk more about that as we go forward. So the Yang family, and then Yang Yang, the researcher from University of Illinois, who may or may not be actually a member of that family. It's kind of like Smith in China. So it's very likely that they're from different Yang families.
Then who presented? Like, there was a big conference of several tracks. One is involved in the practice side, and then the other is involved in sort of the science side. So can you describe a little bit about what was presented and by whom?
The traditional side, in terms of like the track of studying Tai Chi Chuan styles with particular master teachers, the original, kind of the order, shall we say, of these families getting into the Tai Chi mix over the last 500 years is that the Chen family, who is currently represented by Chen Zheng Le, I think it's Zhen Li or Zhen Lei, Chen Zhen Lei, was the presenter. He looked to me like to be about in his mid-60s. I have a real bias to the beauty of the Chen. It was a gorgeous and inspiring experience to be with the current lineage holder of the Chen Village Tai Chi. And the next in the history of the development of Tai Chi historically was the Yang family. And the main representative of the Yang family is Yang Zhendo, who is 83, and who at this event announced the fact that his grandson, Yang Jun, J-U-N, Yang Jun, is going to be the lineage holder there. Then from the Wu family, for some reason there's a little bit more complexity in the Wu family, and so there were two people there representing that lineage. One was Wu Wenhan, probably one of the most archetypal looking Tai Chi masters I've ever seen. Has that very long philosophical Chinese looking beard, and a real philosophical sort of character. Fascinating. And then his Wu family associate, whose last name is Ma Hailong. And then last was the Sun family, and that is the last family that got into the Tai Chi mix, was represented by Sun Yongtian. And it was amazing. I've been studying Tai Chi since 1967, was my first Tai Chi class in Berkeley. I was in during the summer vacation from college, the first time I had ever been west of the Mississippi. I'm from Cincinnati. And so I've been involved with Tai Chi for a really long time, and I've been to China 8 times. I have never seen this much incredible mastery in one spot. It was really a historic experience. Then from the research side, I was there with speaking with Linda Larkey from the University of Arizona. We were presenting on our two papers, the moving meditation paper from the American Journal of Physical Health and I forget what it's called. And the other one is this article that we're going to have published. It's been accepted for publication by the American Journal of Health Promotion. And on the panel with myself was a gentleman from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, where they actually have a Tai Chi program for the staff of the CDC, which I had no idea about. And then the other presenter on my panel was the chief of innovation from the NIH, who was announcing the annual NIH Mind-Body Week and giving a really interesting presentation diffusing new ideas into large populations. Linda was on her panel was Peter Wayne from Harvard and Kevin Chen from the University of Maryland. There were a number of other very impressive presenters. Honestly, at this moment, I'm not looking at those names, unfortunately. There was someone there from the Mayo Clinic and numerous universities around the United States. The science, I thought the science was incredible. I think one of the things that was pointed out as a part of the science and worth mentioning here is that it appears that, particularly since Dr. Larkey and I have published this, or in the process of publishing this article on the benefits of Qigong and Tai Chi as a single body of moving meditation, as opposed to Tai Chi and Qigong being separate bodies of research, there's the emerging opinion that not enough has been done, but plenty has been done on whether Qigong and Tai Chi are effective. And so the science is now wanting to move on to much more practical considerations. One of those considerations is when you do research on Qigong and Tai Chi, it's important to say what you're doing. So in other words, most of the research in the past has been, you know, we studied Qigong or we studied Tai Chi. In the future, we'll be seeing more about when you say we studied Tai Chi, well, what kind of Tai Chi, how many movements was it? Was it sitting? Was it standing? Was there walking steps involved, or was it more stationary? Was there a focus on breath practice and mind focus, or is it basically just Tai Chi as an exercise, et cetera? So one of the great big areas for future research is going to be this whole domain of becoming more specific in the investigation of what about Qigong and Tai Chi causes the benefit. So now that we know that there is a benefit, what about Qigong and Tai Chi causes the benefit? So that's going to be one of the really interesting emerging areas of research. The other really fascinating area of research will have to do with the whole idea of the dosing. You know, how much Qigong or Tai Chi do you need to do? Is it every day? Once a week? Is once a week enough? Does a person need to learn how to do Tai Chi on their own to be able to do the benefit, to gain the benefit? Is there something that makes a Tai Chi or Qigong program more effective? In other words, is it more effective if you have a special kind of a teacher? Is it more effective if you teach people to do these practices on a regular basis without a teacher? You know, all of that. So the other aspect of the research is going to be about application. In other words, where is it best to do this? Like, is it best to do it, in hospitals, YMCAs, in big institutions like universities and the military? Or is it really a kind of a personal practice, and it should it be the kind of thing that people gain the capacity to do on their own, any place they are? So there's a lot of really fascinating breakthrough sort of next steps that'll be happening in the research side of things. So Tom, I know that I kind of rambled on, but you asked both about the master's side and science side, and I'd be willing to, go into depth on either one of those.
Well, I got the idea that the Tai Chi side was more practice oriented, and that's certainly reasonably straightforward. I think I'm pretty interested in what happened on what else happened on the science side. What was reported there during the conference? In addition to your great work with Linda Larkey at Arizona State, what else was presented that was particularly noteworthy on the science side?
Well, I think I mentioned most of it just a moment ago. However, I will add one thing, which is that science in the final analysis is really super exciting to people like ourselves who are watching the cutting edge of a new possibility for our society, both in terms of function and health function, physiological and psychological, work function, productivity enhancement, and so forth. But all in all, science is kind of humdrum, right? So to a certain extent, a lot of it had to do with scientific methodologies, which average people who are interested in Qigong and Tai Chi really don't have much of an interest in. And a lot of it had to do with about the whole concept of how to structure a study so that it gets more credibility and so forth. Otherwise, the findings were basically all the stuff that Dr. Larkey and I summarized in this big paper that's going to be published by the American Journal of Health Promotion. But I can reflect for a moment on this because I think it would be worth it for the listeners to know about this. So in numerous presentations given by many scientific presenters and research presenters at this event, what came out in the final analysis, what was the sort of so what about the whole thing, was really this concept of how many really well-done studies have been done on what areas of health. And the most important ones are really three. And this is, I think, the big, big punchline, and I think it's probably what you were asking for, Tom. Because otherwise, none of the science really went to the question of, like, what is qi? or there was very little in the area of investigating the nature of the essential mechanism for how Qigong works. Although Shin Lin was there from UCSD, I think it is.
UC Irvine.
Yes, UC Irvine. And he did talk a little bit about mechanisms, but most of the research was on outcomes. And so in the paper that Linda and I are publishing in the American Journal of Health Promotion, what we found in looking at all of the research on Qigong and Tai Chi is that there are 77 studies that were done in a way that fits what we believe in the Western world to be credible research. And by the way, for those of you who are not that interested in the research side of things, hold on to your hats for just a few minutes, because we want to talk more about some of the real most impressive breakthrough ideas that happened at this culture, this conference, which were not really in the science meetings. They were someplace else. But back to this issue of numbers of well-done studies, that's randomized controlled trials. It turns out that the highest number of credible studies in the area of psychological and emotional, the effect of Qigong and Tai Chi on psychological and emotional states. Now, why this is critical is because stress is has an impact on every kind of disease and every kind of social problem. Regarding the military, there's a strong push now in the military to move to a healthcare model that includes wellness and prevention. And when you put people in harm's way and they're suffering from PTSD, that is post-traumatic stress disorder, once they have that disorder, they're not very well in the position to learn something new. So Qigong and Tai Chi is something that soldiers can learn, kids can learn in high school, people who are in drug and alcohol programs can learn. In other words, it can be implemented not just as a solution to a disease state, it can be implemented in such a way as to prevent the disease state from progressing. And the fact that this psychological and stress angle is the most widely researched aspect of Tai Chi and Qigong is profound, because what it does is it says when people who are doing programming anywhere from corporations all the way down through school systems, and that person who's going to decide about a program says, well, let's see, well, we're going to look at this program and we're going to look at this Tai Chi and Qigong program. And then you ask the question, which one of these programs has the most research and evidence about it? And typically the program will be chosen is the one that has the most, quote, evidence. And because stress is such a powerful impact on our lives in almost every way and is a very aggravating feature of many diseases, it is very impressive that the top number of credible studies looked at outcomes in the area of psychology and emotional functionality. So that was huge. And a lot of reporting by the other presentations corroborated that. And then the second thing was falls. And everybody knows that, well, maybe not everybody knows, but it turns out that falling down and breaking a bone is, in many cases, sort of the beginning of the end of life in many people's cases. And it turns out that falls, most kinds of falling are preventable. And so the second largest number, psychological, 27 randomized controlled trials. Falls is 23 randomized controlled trials. And then the third one, which is also very, very impressive for our society, is cardiovascular. So 19 credible studies investigated Qigong and Tai Chi for their influence, positive influence and benefits in cardiological and cardiovascular disease, and the fact that there were 19 is huge. Now, some of the lower numbers, just so you know, is, for instance, there are 4 studies in bone density. There's quite a few more, actually, in the area of what's called self-efficacy, which is interesting because there were 8 studies in self-efficacy, and if you define self-efficacy in a certain way, it actually goes into the psychological, so that actually drives the number of psychological studies up to 36 or something like that. So in answer to your question, what was some of the most important stuff that came through on the science? It was that there's so much out there. It's done. In other words, we used to say, gee, you know, is there any evidence of the relevance and benefit of Qigong and Tai Chi? And everybody'd scratch their head and say, well, I don't know. But now we know that there are 77 credibly done randomized controlled trials that demonstrate these benefits. And in terms of policy, what that means is that policymakers can say, well, what are we going to include in this program? Well, let's put in this and let's put in that. Well, how do we decide? Well, the decision is made these days, may not always have been and may not always be, but these days it's based on evidence. And the magnitude of the evidence for Qigong and Tai Chi is huge.
You mentioned stress, and I think that it'd be really interesting for people to know about the research that was done at the Massachusetts General Hospital on the gene level research that actually shows proof positive that Qigong is anti-aging practice.
Oh boy, I love it that you brought that up. Because that's now where the science sort of meets our longing as individuals and as social beings to, you know, maybe not live forever, but at least live well for as long as we possibly can, and you know, experience vitality and a dynamic life experience. And probably the cutting edge. And by the way, there were no presentations on this subject at this conference, as far as I could tell. I did mention it in my slides. because I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't restrain myself. So let me just talk about it a little bit. Herbert Benson at Harvard University is considered by many to be the father of mind-body medicine. He's certainly, at the very minimum, the first person who articulated the relaxation response that exists within the human system as an opposite to the stress response or what's called the fight or flight response. And the autonomic nervous system has its two sides, the go side and the no-go side. It's kind of like the yin and yang regarding the nervous system. And we know that the detrimental effects of stress are immense, but we're only just beginning to understand the positive benefits of reducing stress, eliminating stress, avoiding stress, neutralizing stress, etc. And it turns out, without belaboring it too much, because it's a very complex area, this whole issue of gene expression, it turns out that one of the most important measures of gene health and gene functionality, and by the way, gene longevity, in other words, the length of time that a gene can reproduce itself and continue to make healthy tissue in a well body, comes under the influence of stress. And it also comes under the influence of the opposite of stress, which is the relaxation response. And it turns out that there's a little sub-portion of the gene which is called the telomere. And people who are listening may remember that even probably as much as 10 years ago, there were some articles about what was called the cellular clock. The cellular clock being the aspect of the human cell that's ticking until it runs down. And the idea was that in this kind of breakthrough science of about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less, was that when the clock runs down, you die. And one of the bits of evidence of the clock running down is that these little subportions of the genetic material called telomeres would shrink and basically become dysfunctional. And so it's been assumed all along that, you know, we have a certain amount of life. If we live hard and abuse ourselves, that makes the clock tick faster, et cetera, given a multitude of other features. It's always been presumed that you can't get that back. Once you've spent it, you can't get it back. And in fact, this goes to a big argument that exists in Chinese medicine and Taoism and Chinese philosophy and so forth around the three treasures and the Jing, Qi, Shen. And the argument is that some parties say that you only get a certain amount of Jing, which is very much associated with the genes and the genetic material. And once you've spent that Jing, you will become sick and you will die. The opposing view says that you have the capacity to rejuvenate your Jing. And this work that Benson and his team have done with gene expression uses a number of different parameters. The one that people recognize the most readily is called rate or pace of cell mortality, pace of cell mortality, meaning the rate at which cells are dying. And it turns out that when you do practices that are associated with triggering the relaxation response, that it decreases the rate of cell death. And the reason for that is that when you remove the negative effects of stress from the system, these telomeres, instead of shrinking, they can actually turn around and go the other way and get larger. And this is probably one of the most startling, sort of world-shaking, if you will, findings of modern science. And that is this whole idea of the fact that what we thought could only get smaller and then finally become deficient and finally dysfunctional can actually be turned around. These telomeres can actually grow in size. So in terms of the Jing conversation from the Chinese side, not only is there an influence on how much you're spending the Jing or destroying the Jing, it appears to me that there's a definite angle on this where you can say, and with proper attention, you can actually rehabilitate the Jing and make the Jing more robust, which would mean that you would live longer and be more well. Now, one last thing to say about this is that people say, well, that's kind of vain, you know, just wanting to live longer. But that's not what this is all about. It's not length of time. It's actually about living well for as long as possible. I think that that's the more practical application to this whole concept of longevity, because who wants unwell longevity, if you know what I mean? So we can talk more on that, but that's most of it.
Okay, earlier you said something about the biggest breakthrough at the conference. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there were a couple of things on this, and this really goes back now to Chinese history, Chinese culture, Chinese philosophy, Chinese medicine, the traditions of Qigong and Tai Chi over the millennia and so forth. And most people are familiar with the kind of idea that says, you know, my teacher is better than your teacher. You know, if you don't do this kind of Kung Fu or Tai Chi, then you're not doing the right Tai Chi. And because of the nature of the Chinese culture, it would be likely that it would be like this. And this is my view, my investigation. I've been to China 8 times, and you know, I've read everything that I can get my hands on that's been translated into English because my Chinese is not that excellent. But it comes clear over time, if you're a real scholar or a sort of sustainably a student of these things, like Qigong and Tai Chi and Chinese medicine, that the reason why those families were fighting was because everybody was fighting. The Chinese society, we think of these dynasties as lasting for long periods of time, but actually average dynasties or near-average dynasties were often as short as 40 years, 27 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. Really, that's about the life of one emperor plus a couple of years of whatever emperor followed that emperor. And it's typical in Chinese history for these dynasties to rise and fall that hard and that fast. And as you can imagine, these were not democratic elections. These were violent, blood-spilling overthrows, typically led, by the way, by sects, S-E-C-T-S, sects. And in China, what sects, S-E-C-T-S, are schools of philosophy and schools of Buddhism and Taoism, and to a certain extent Confucianism, although Confucianism was never thrown out of the imperial court because it was the way of keeping order in the court. But in terms of what went on outside the walls of the Forbidden City, the Buddhists and the Taoists were always kind of going back and forth. And you might say to yourself, but what I thought they were all spiritual monks. Why would they be fighting with each other? And the answer is that politics is never more spiritual than it is political. And so these people are constantly involved in protecting the imperial court, protecting the monasteries, and so forth. And so it's not unlikely that there would be a mood in the Qigong and Tai Chi and martial arts communities that's based on this idea that, you know, if I give you my secrets, you'll kill me. If we make friends, then later I'm going to have to kill a friend, and, you know, like that kind of stuff. It's sort of unfamiliar to us here in the Western world, where we live in a fairly Jeffersonian and collegial and complementary sort of society. So I have been, and probably you, Tom, and others who are listening here, have been in those environments where at some point somebody said, well, you know, if you don't do it this way, you won't be able to defend yourself, and if you can't defend yourself, then you will die, or, you know, if you don't study with this teacher, you won't be able to survive in a battle. But then also there would be these other things that would be said by, for instance, if you don't study with this teacher, you won't have the truth of life. And if you want to get to heaven or if you want to have a successful life, you have to surrender to the fact that you must be in a relationship with a master teacher from a particular lineage, et cetera, et cetera. So that whole playing field has been a part of the experience of many people who have been involved in Qigong and Tai Chi and the martial arts over all these last 3-4 decades. And you would expect, frankly, I expected to go to this Tai Chi symposium and see a lot of push hands going on, and push hands being a little bit of a Tai Chi contest to see who's the most well-rooted and so forth. And I did see push hands happening, but it was actually fairly minimal, And I saw nothing of the enmity or one-upmanship or prideful boasting at this event. It was just amazing. And as I said earlier, the kids from the Chen family were standing right in the front row at the Yang family teaching, and the kids from the Yang family were in the Chen family classes, and the really excellent young woman from the Wu family was studying. I saw her at one point in the Yang classes and so forth. So there was a kind of collegiality, a kind of peaceful coexistence, a kind of mutual support at this event that I've never really witnessed this before in the area of the martial arts and Tai Chi and Qigong. It was fantastic. And you guys know me. Many of you who are listening know, you know, the Institute of Integral Qigong and Tai Chi as an organization that kind of doesn't believe in masters, and I mean, we believe in masters and honor masters, but in terms of like the emerging Qigong and Tai Chi here in the Western world for practical application, the IIQTC is a real spokes organization for leveling the playing field and making Qigong and Tai Chi easier and more accessible, and taking out all of that one-upmanship and that superiority. And that's why we call it integral. That's the definition of the Integral Institute, is that it's not based on people or masters or lineages. It's based on principles. And so I was just blown away, thrilled, amazed to be having this experience. It was really probably one of the most profound experiences that I've ever had in my professional life, given the fact that my profession is Qigong. It felt to me like we'd entered the 21st century somehow. And I even asked a couple of people, I said, is this, you know, is the way you guys are acting, does it have something to do with what it's like to live in a socialistic country? I mean, have you basically finally just fallen under the influence of the leveling of the Cultural Revolution and so forth? And nobody really felt comfortable with answering that question. And people in China who have experienced the Cultural Revolution absolutely hate to talk about it. It's just the least favorite thing in people's minds. But I really did get the impression that something is going on in the Tai Chi and Qigong world in China, which could mean that something is going on in China, period. I mean, some kind of a good thing going on in China, period. Really, really thrilling experience of hearing these teachers, these older lineage holders, giving voice to collegial and collaborative and mutual supportive language. It was beautiful, just beautiful.
Were those people, the lineage holders, et cetera, were they interested in the scientific side, or were they... Was their interest maybe calibrated a bit by the fact that it was probably presented in English?
Well, I think it probably was calibrated a bit, but, you know, the truth is that the Chinese, actually, I shouldn't say that it's the truth, because it's my opinion. The Chinese society, for every time I've been to China, I've noticed one thing. Number one, people are lovely and very, very hospitable and social, very, really socially adept and kind. But it is a widely held opinion in China that China is the center of the world. And in fact, China, the name of China in Chinese is Zhongguo. Zhongguo. Zhong means center. So there's an attitude in China which says that our view that our paradigm is basically trumps every other paradigm. And so there's an inherent cultural askanceness, if you will, of science. I mean, think of it this way. Here in the Western world, we're trying to prove to ourselves that something works. But these people knew that it worked 3,000 years ago, and they asked and answered that question a long time ago. So the whole idea of hanging around with a bunch of Westerners who are debating whether Qigong and Tai Chi has any value, it's kind of, you know, silly to these people. This is my thought. I mean, they've never said that. But no, I didn't see any of those families, any of the representatives of those families in the scientific sessions.
Is the symposium going to publish any proceedings or maybe a consensus report which would be similar to, say, the national expert meeting on Qigong and Tai Chi?
It appears to me that there is an attempt to put together proceedings, but what was interesting is that a number of the people who would have been published, the information that they were presenting at the event has already been published someplace else. Just like with Dr. Larkey and my moving meditation article, and then this one that's coming up for the benefits of Qigong and Tai Chi in American Journal of Health Promotion, there's actually a sort of a, I don't know if it's an unwritten rule or an actual rule that says if you've published a paper in a certain context, you can't or you shouldn't publish it someplace else. And so there's a discussion going on right now because the people who ran the conference are asking for submissions of these papers, and I know that both Linda and myself have been wanting to participate with the proceedings process, but we've got to figure out how to give the information in such a way that it's not actually, you know, done like as that published article.
What about modifying Tai Chi for practical applications? You had some thoughts
right,
on that.
Right. Well, this is the other miracle of this event. It was just amazing to me. I mean, I absolutely had no idea that this would happen at this event. So as you know, there are the long form Tai Chi, the short form. Long form, in most cases, is considered to be 108 movements. Well, one of the interesting little minor details is that I kept hearing the people from China talking about them as 103 movements. It was almost like laughable because, you know, here we are in the Western world always saying 108, 108. But I heard many more times than I heard 108, I heard 103, which surprised me. I'd never heard anything about that. And then, as many who are listening know, the long forms, because they are, in fact, quite long, over time, all of these families have developed what are called short forms. And there's a 56-movement short form. There's a 42-movement short form. There are other, there's a 32 and a 38 I've ever heard of. And the most famous one is the Beijing 24 or the Yang 24. Now, those are all considered to be, you know, shall we say, shorter than anybody who's really involved in, who's shorter than anybody who's pursuing this seriously would participate in. In a way, it was kind of another one of those sort of put-down things. If you don't know a long form, then you don't really know Tai Chi. And yet, for practical purposes in China, with the industrial use of Tai Chi in manufacturing plants and the farms and with kids in schools and so forth, the short form seemed to be reasonable. And typically, the attitude has been anything less than 24, and you're joking. You know, it's not really eligible to be called Tai Chi. Well, take that back. It's like, you know, we say sometimes that the master went away on a retreat, came back, and changed everything. And so check this out. These families got together, and under the influence of somebody, and I have no idea who, they all agreed to create what they call a 16 form. And so when we were there at Vanderbilt with the what they call them, grand masters. I'm still a little unsure about the whole idea of a grand master, but just for the sake of this conversation, we'll say grand masters. We're each teaching the 16 form from their family tradition. So it would be the Chen 16 form, the Yang 16 form, etc. It was amazing to be in the presence of these lineage holders. So we're not talking about their kids doing this in secret. We're talking about these lineage-holding elders having reached a decision that was reasonable to create a 16 form. And each one of them, as I heard them explaining it, and it's interesting because they were kind of explaining and rationalizing, because after all, you know, if you've spent your life saying that anybody who does less than a long form is kind of, you know, a lesser being, shall we say, then later you come back and you say, well, I changed my mind. So you have to have a reason for why that was. And the reason, as far as I could tell, it seemed to be fairly across the board, was, and it was almost like a party line, if you know what I mean, that in modern China, people have a less of this kind of time. And so for convenience, and I would add probably for the sustainability of Tai Chi and Qigong, in other words, so that they actually continue to exist, these modified forms were necessary. Now, here's the cherry on top. If you happen to be someone who's an integral thinker, there's one more cherry on top here, and it really blew my mind. But before I give you the total punchline of the whole interview, let me first say that each of the families was very insistent that when you learn their Tai Chi, whether it's long form, short form, or 16 form modified, that it's absolutely critical that you do the moves correctly. And it was probably the most often heard words were, no, that's wrong. So an example would be, well, if you do it like this, no, that's wrong. If you do it like this, no, that's wrong. So they definitely are not using the rule that it's better to do it wrong than not at all. So it's kind of like splitting, say, well, okay, we'll give you a shorter form, but we're not going to give up on the idea that you have to get it right. And, you know, that seems fair. I mean, how much can ancient traditions evolve, you know, in a brief period of time? So it's very exciting to just see the modification being rationalized, because it basically, for those of us who work with the Institute of Integral Qigong and Tai Chi, the concept of modifying the practice, whether it's Tai Chi or Qigong, is the bottom line, because we're less interested in protecting tradition and more interested in the benefits for our society. So now here comes the cherry on top punchline, is that I heard both Chen Zhenglei and Yang Zhenduo say this, and they both got big waves of laughter with this. And it was like this, say, well, you know, given the fact that we've felt comfortable with breaking this down to 16 movements, I actually have to say, this is kind of like paraphrasing, it's not a quote, we would really have to say that in all honesty, it doesn't matter how many movements you do. What matters the most is that you do something. And Yang Zhenduo actually even and he got the biggest laugh off of this one, said, you know, if you don't have time or if you're not well enough, then just do one movement. And if you can't get out of your chair, do that movement sitting down. And if you can't walk, do that movement standing. And it was like listening to a colleague from this whole domain of integral thinking, the ideal, the baseline, the hardest line there is that Qigong and Tai Chi are not to prove a point. Qigong and Tai Chi are not, it's not that important for them to be a certain package. What's important is for them to provide support and support for people who are unwell and improving their health, and to provide tools for people who want to maximize themselves productivity-wise, fun-wise, sex-wise, lifestyle-wise, life skill-wise. And it was, I just about dropped to my knees when I heard Yang Zhenduo, the oldest one, the Yang family grand elder, say, you know, it's not important how much of this you do. It's not really important how you do it. It's important that you do something to support yourself and be more well. And actually, underneath there was the social message of China, which I think is pretty much the same as the Jeffersonian message in the Western world, which is we're all working together to improve our society. And so that's the most important thing. Let's get the work done that we need to get done, and let's have enough energy left over to have some fun in our lives and pay attention to our families. So for me, going to this international symposium, due to my biases regarding integral thinking and the whole concept of principle-based Qigong and Tai Chi, I had like a rebirth. Actually, it wasn't a rebirth because I'm already born into that. It was kind of like having these great grand masters saying, you know, they were talking to the whole room, but I felt them talking to me saying, you know, you're right on, and you keep going, and, you know, you keep working with how to inspire people and support people in improving their lives, because that's the baseline of what Tai Chi is all about.
So just to clarify on the 16 movement thing, does that mean there's a Sun 16 movement, a Yang 16 movement, and a Chen 16 movement, or there's one 16 movement that everybody's doing?
Well, okay, great. I'm so glad you asked, Tom, because this is something that I'm getting ready to announce to my colleagues at the Institute of Integral Qigong and Tai Chi. The answer to your question is that there's one of each. But my new fantasy, my new project for the Integral Institute is to now take those four family, the essential nature of the four families. Like, for instance, the Chen family is more aggressive, not aggressive, it's more engaged as a physical activity. It's more sinking. It has all that spiraling and the fa jing. To take that quality from the Chen and then from the Yang, to take that kind of smooth, somewhat martial feeling and appearing, though not aggressively, of course, because it's Tai Chi feeling, and then to take that Wu feeling of that kind of angular posture and the sort of intelligence. The Wu is really widely practiced among scholars and philosophers. And then to take that mood from the Sun, which is it's kind of like Qigong inside Tai Chi. They even, in Sun style, they do this opening and closing the hands, just like we do sometimes when we do a practice called finding the Qi or discovering the Qi. So to actually make a 16 form that has four sections, that has four movements in each section, and to be able to try to capture the most integral convergence in a simple, you know, brief form. This is, I got all excited about that, and it's something that I'm really interested in doing.
Sort of as a final question here, do you see any, like, follow-up to this conference? Do you feel like the timing of the symposium was, like, critical or coincidental with all that's happening with U.S. healthcare or with where complementary and alternative medicine is headed right now?
Well, I'm positive that it was definitely well-placed in terms of all of that. I think to some extent it was coincidental, and I think in the final analysis we will be kind of disappointed with whatever any kind of government comes up with as a healthcare plan. But the beauty of it is that with complementary medicine and mind-body practice, so much of it is based on human beings learning more about themselves. So even if the government comes up with a stupid health plan, which it almost guaranteed to do, the hedge is that if you are one of those citizens who practices Qigong, and if you're one of those citizens who does exchanges, shoulder massage with your spouse or your friend or your coworker, and if you're somebody who is reading books about diet and nutrition and learning more about how to avoid the problems that food sensitivities can cause in your life and so forth, that doesn't really matter. Now the healthcare system matters less because the average citizen's more in charge. So I don't know how much of that's going to happen in our lifetime, but a little bit of it is already happening. Now, in terms of what might happen in the future, what I noticed as a founder of the National Qigong Association and have been noticing for 20 years is that Tai Chi does not have a national association. And it's my belief that given the fact that the great masters are basically saying, you know, what we're really talking about here in the final analysis is doing Qigong, because when you do one Tai Chi movement, how much like the Tai Chi is that? So it's Qigong. They're talking about Qigong. But I'd like to see an effort to bring Qigong and Tai Chi together under one association. And I think I don't know how soon it's going to be that an event like the one at Vanderbilt will happen again. But I think that on an annual basis, the Qigong and Tai Chi communities could get together just like the Qigong community has been doing. But what I do think for sure is that there's going to be plenty of Qigong and Tai Chi happening in the Western world, and the research is going to refine itself. And this whole idea of integral Qigong and Tai Chi, which is based less on lineages and specific ways that you must do things and more on the practical application of health enhancement, all of that is going to be expanding, evolving, maximizing.
This has been an interview with Dr. Roger Yonka about the first International Tai Chi Chuan Symposium on Health Education and Cultural Exchange held in the U.S. in July 2009 at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Yonka has been at the forefront of promoting Qigong and Tai Chi for over 30 years. He's a co-founder of the National Qigong Association, a licensed Oriental medical doctor, author of several texts on Qigong and self-healing practices, and an international lecturer. For more information on seminars and training offered by Dr. Yonka, visit his websites, iiqtc.org, Feel the Qi, all one word, FeelTheQi.com, or TaiChiEasy.org, all one word, TaiChiEasy.org. The Qigong Institute is run by volunteers, so donations are greatly appreciated to support the Qigong Institute program, such as this broadcast and the operation of the website. We also invite you to find out more about Qigong at the Qigong Institute website, which is qigonginstitute.org, where Qigong is spelled Q-I-G-O-N-G. there's information about this podcast as well as research mentioned on this podcast.